The pair was demonstrating a distributed hypertext system Berners-Lee had built to make sharing data on networked computers across their massive Swiss campus a little easier. To anyone who saw it in 1991, it would have looked something like note cards or Apple's HyperCard. Small graphical pages connected by links. The major difference was that these pages didn't all live on the same computer. Berners-Lee and Caillot, in the hopes of making data accessible to physicists outside of CERN, had built their hypertext system on the backbone of the academic internet. They called it the World Wide Web. To demonstrate the World Wide Web, Berners-Lee and Caillot brought their own computer with them on the plane from Geneva, a $10,000 jet-black Next Cube, at the time the only machine capable of running Berners-Lee's graphical World Wide Web browser. Still, the hypertext community wasn't impressed. "He said you needed an internet connection," remembers Kathy Marshall, and I thought, well, that's expensive. Wendy Hall took a break from her own demo to try the web on the conference floor. "I was looking at it," she remembers, laughing ruefully, "and I'm thinking, these links, they're embedded in the documents, and they're only going one way. This is really too simplistic." They were right. It was expensive. Although Stanford had established the first stateside web server only 3 days before, the hotel in San Antonio wasn't fronting for an internet connection. So Berners-Lee and Caillot were forced to demo a dummy version of the web, saved on optical disk. And it was too simplistic. Compared with the other systems on display, the web's version of hypertext was years behind. Links on the World Wide Web went in only one direction, to a single destination, and they were contextual, tethered to their point of origin, rather than generic, like Wendy's microcosm links. Instead of employing a link base that could update documents automatically when links were moved or deleted, the web embedded links in documents themselves. "That was all considered counter to what we were doing at the time," Kathy adds. "It was kind of like, well, we know better than to do that." Because the demonstrations at Hypertext 91 were scheduled after all the day's lectures and discussions, many delegates skipped the session entirely. Reporting after the fact, a contributor to the field's journal of record, the ACM Sig Chi Bulletin, noted that she had little energy left to see and understand the demos, let alone try to conduct an intelligent conversation about them. Of the 21 demos on display, she managed to examine only 6, one of which was the World Wide Web. In what amounts to little more than a footnote in her trip report, she calls it a hypertext-like interface, intended for the high-energy physics community. Nothing in the proceedings of Hypertext 91 suggests how quickly the World Wide Web would come to dominate the lives of people all around the world, and indeed, to alter the course of human history. In San Antonio, it was just one of many systems on display, and far from the most sophisticated. It certainly didn't help that the techno-social activities of Hypertext 91 featured a tequila fountain in the courtyard outside the hotel. The very moment the World Wide Web was making its American debut, everybody was outside drinking margaritas. But the web suffered little from its snub in Texas. By Hypertext 93, more than half the demos on display were web-based. And at the European Conference on Hypertext in 94, Berners-Lee delivered the keynote address. During that brief window, hypertext and the web managed an uneasy coexistence. Kathy Marshall proposed that hypertext systems could serve as desktop workspaces for information gathered online, and HyperCard wasn't pulled from the shelves until 2004. Wendy Hall, who had weathered the transition to the web more successfully than many of her peers, updated Microcosm to include a web viewer, and she designed versions of her beloved link bases that could be shared over a distributed network. Today, we mostly think of hypertext as being something related to the web, rather than of the web as a technically inferior manifestation of hypertext principles. The web is hypertext's killer app, just as email was the internet's killer app. But its success hit the hypertext community hard. I'm not sure exactly how to describe it, Kathy Marshall tells me. All of a sudden, you're the outsider, when you'd been the insider. At the first World Wide Web conference in 1994, Wendy Hall noticed that many delegates thought the web was the first hypertext system, and she was stunned to read a paper reinventing her generic link ideas from scratch. By 1997, the two fields were so divergent that the hypertext and World Wide Web conferences were scheduled for the exact same week. To this day, the World Wide Web suffers from problems that systems like Microcosm solved decades ago. Because web links are entirely dependent on their context, they're almost impossible to maintain. If a website is moved, deleted, or hidden behind a paywall, every link that pointed to it becomes meaningless, dangling like an anchor line cut loose from a ship. This should be familiar to anyone who has spent 5 minutes browsing the web. According to a 2013 study, the median lifespan of a web page is 9.3 years, a rate of obsolescence that sows rotten links throughout the network over time. We all regularly experience these dead ends, which are called 404 errors. The document you're looking for, they tell us, simply cannot be found. The hypertext researchers who demoed the World Wide Web back in San Antonio assumed this issue would be the system's undoing. After all, what good is a hypertext system if the links don't even work? Further, the web isn't constructive. In all of the major pre-web hypertext systems, Microcosm, Notecards, Aquanet, Viki, and Intermedia, creating links was just as important as clicking them. The point was for users to build their own paths through the material, a creative process of forging associative trails that could be shared with others. The web, however, is a passive medium, a highway we wander without leaving much of a trace. The World Wide Web may not have been powerful enough for academics, but a lightweight, user-friendly tool is often more likely to take off than a vastly more powerful one. And while link bases and constructive hypertext were easily maintained in relatively contained research and classroom environments, or on small networks of computers all running the same operating system, they would have quickly become unmanageable on a global scale. Today, we accept 404 errors as the cost of doing business, and the web runs the world. Multicosm. The second time I talk to Wendy Hall, she's finishing up a long day with the department she now chairs at Southampton, the Web Science Institute. As I reach her on Skype, she's just saying goodbye to the last students trailing out of the conference room where they've been meeting. "Claire's writing a book about me," she says, laughing to someone I can't see, gesturing at my head on the screen. Or people like me, anyway. Wendy will be the first to tell you that she's a very social person. She loves to make connections with people and between them. When she talks, she does so in long, unself-conscious streams, jumping from one big, seemingly unrelated idea to another on her own invisible tracks, the mark of a true hypertext researcher. She loves science fiction and asks me repeatedly if I've read Douglas Adams's Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy or Isaac Asimov's Foundation series. These novels contain her go-to analogies. The World Wide Web, she says, is an experiment on the whole world, just like the white mice in Hitchhiker's Guide, who run through mazes to test the scientists. And trying to understand the web is like studying Isaac Asimov's Psychohistory, a mathematics of social complexity that can predict the rise and fall of galaxies. Back in 1991, after drinking her fill of courtyard margaritas in San Antonio, Wendy went back to Southampton to continue developing her multimedia hypertext system, Microcosm. To survive, it needed to adapt to changing times. This it did admirably. For every new form of media, Wendy and her team developed new Microcosm viewers, windows, through which its users could draw material into their growing personal link bases. There were Microcosm digital video viewers for video laser discs, viewers for animation, sound, and 3D models, and viewers for competing hypertext systems. After San Antonio, however, Wendy was careful to add one more. A viewer for the World Wide Web. The Microcosm Web Viewer served as a hypertext replacement for the standard web browser. Where browsers like Mosaic and later Netscape and Internet Explorer were read-only, Microcosm users could, using their web viewer, select text from anywhere on the web to use as the starting point or destination of their own hypertext threads, linking to other web pages, multimedia documents, and their personal Microcosm link bases. This all seemed to Wendy to be the most natural thing in the world. Many in the hypertext community balked at the web's brutal simplicity, but Wendy corrected for it, layering her robust and proprietary system on top of the more skeletal world of interlinked web pages. "I saw the web through a Microcosm viewer," she explains. Of course, Tim saw it completely the other way around. Like many hypertext researchers, Wendy had every reason to assume that her system could happily coexist with the web. After all, Microcosm worked better. It didn't suffer from dead links. And where the web connected web pages only to one another, Microcosm connected word processor documents, spreadsheets, videos, images, and CAD files like a micro-internet interlinking everything on the desktop. You could follow links to many different destinations, she says. You could have one-to-one, one-to-many, many-to-many links. And you could reverse it all. Because Microcosm links were stored in a database rather than embedded into documents, the system could generate new connections on the fly, tailoring itself to individual users' browsing habits. "I was still thinking of the web as one of the systems we would use," Wendy says. What she didn't anticipate is the network effect. Because the web was built on top of the internet, and because it was free, early adopters quickly gave way to more mainstream users, and the more people got on the web, the more interesting it became to their friends and family, and so on, very quickly making it dominant. Meanwhile, the Microcosm team released new stopgaps. They streamlined the system's key concepts, its generic links and link bases, into a web browser add-on called the Distributed Link Service, which made any browser into a kind of Microcosm Lite, applying generic linking principles to the interchange between client and server. Effectively, this allowed web users to interrogate material on the web, regardless of whether an explicit link was there. By enhancing the web with Microcosm's link services, World Wide Web readers would be freed from the tyranny of the button, Wendy's team wrote in a 1994 paper. The tyranny of the button, however, prevailed. People navigating the web for the first time, few of whom had any experience with the kind of hypertext people like Wendy and Kathy created, were perfectly happy to click buttons. Roaming with no clear destination along the web's labyrinthine paths. Such curiosity-driven derives were, in fact, part of the web's early appeal. When people hit a dead end, they went back and tried a different link. The maze was a mess, but it was worth running. Had Wendy's team at Southampton concentrated its energies differently, it's very possible that Microcosm could have been the first graphical web browser to really take off. But that would have entailed making the software as free to use as the web itself. And Wendy's team had its sights on commercializing their efforts. In 1994, they established Multicosm Limited. If one Microcosm is a window on the world, their company would produce many. The timing couldn't have been worse. "People used to say," she remembers and laughs, "I think what you're doing is wonderful, but this web thing is free, so we're going to try that first." Fortunately, Wendy never abandoned university life. Running an expanding department at Southampton, she remained in contact with the growing web development community. And after working closely with Tim Berners-Lee to develop the Microcosm Web Viewer and the Distributed Link Service, she became a sustained presence on the early web scene. In 1994, she helped to organize the first web conference, but still wasn't confident that the web was the end-all solution. In a 1997 lecture at Southampton, she minced no words. "The web has shown us that global hypertext is possible, but it has also shown us that it is easier to put rubbish on the net than anything of real and lasting value, she said. How right she was. There is a coda to this story, however. Microcosm's ideas may not have been implemented on a global scale in their day, but their prescience is undeniable. The way Wendy's system created links dynamically, based on the context of the information being linked, was a form of what we now call metadata. We are now, 27 years after the web, living in a world that is driven by data, Wendy reminds me. How and why that data are linked is becoming increasingly important, especially as we teach machines to interpret connections for us. In order for artificial intelligence to understand the web, it will need an additional layer of machine-readable information on top of our documents, a kind of meta-web that proponents call the semantic web. While humans might understand connections intuitively and are willing to ignore when links rot or lead nowhere, computers require more consistent information about the source, the destination, and the meaning of every link. That was the core of Microcosm, Wendy says. When she began to participate in building the semantic web in the 2000s, it was so exciting because I could see all my original research ideas coming to life in the web world. We still couldn't do all the things we could do in Microcosm in the 90s, but we could see how effective our link bases were. In the end, however, the system is immaterial to her. It's the connections she's after. The magnificent complexity of human society and thought, all influencing one another in the unfolding of history. There's lots of different ways that we could have implemented a global hypertext system, Wendy says. The web won, for now. But it feels like this is an experiment that has involved the entire world. Have you read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Part 3. The Early True Believers. Chapter 11. Miss Outerboro. The internet exists at the confluence of culture, code, and infrastructure. As the technology historian Janet Abate writes, communications media often seem to dematerialize technology, presenting themselves to the user as systems that transmit ideas rather than electrons. This makes the boundary between users and producers, and between software and hardware, so porous as to be effectively permeable. As the story of hypertext shows, technology alone isn't enough to change the world. It has to be implemented in an accessible way and adopted by a community of users who feel enough ownership over it to invent new applications far beyond the imagination of its architects. To make successful links, in short, we need things worth linking. Even as it eclipsed the more complex hypertext systems preceding it, the web didn't transform the world on its own. A generation of smart, creative, non-academic, and non-technical users had to come along first to forge the connections that would make up the vastly interdependent network we love, or love to hate, today. To fill the container with content, these users would need to be intensely familiar with both computers and culture. They'd need to know how to build and connect. They'd need to understand how something that organizes information can also inspire thought. Fortunately, there were plenty of people like that on Echo. One of them called herself Miss Outerboro. Marisa Bowe was a teenager in the 1970s when her dad brought home a wood-paneled box with a square plasma gas screen that glowed faintly orange. He installed it in the basement of the family house in suburban Minneapolis, near Lake Minnetonka, where they would speedboat in the summer. It wasn't a personal computer. It would be several decades before those turned up in suburban basements nationwide. Rather, it was a terminal. Mute until the home phone, coupled into a cradle fit for the purpose, dialed the network of supercomputers that that brought it to life. Marisa's father was a PR executive at the Control Data Corporation, an old-school mainframe computer company. In the 1960s, they produced the fastest supercomputers in the world. But by the time Marisa was a teenager, her father's company was placing a risky bet on computer-assisted education, wagering that teachers might someday be replaced with electronic learning systems running specialized software. They called this Programmed Logic for Automatic Teaching Operations, or PLATO. The software was built on their mainframes. The PLATO model was to offer distributed, low-cost education, with a number of centrally hosted teaching programs accessed remotely by students at glowing orange terminals like the one in Marisa's basement. Although PLATO terminals would eventually be installed in universities and schools from Illinois to Cape Town, very few people would ever have one at home. Not that Marisa took advantage of her unique situation to learn anything. PLATO offered lessons in everything from arithmetic to Hebrew, but she used it to talk to boys. "I didn't have any interest in programming," she tells me, "but I discovered there was live chat. So I started up a flirtation with my father's boss's son. You would sort of be able to see who was online. There were very few people ever online. And here I was, a teenage girl, and they were all boys. But I was shy in real life. I think people asked me what I was wearing. It didn't get dirty or anything like that, but it was very flirty, and it was really fun." Wherever PLATO terminals were installed, students were chatting, posting messages about science fiction, women's rights, football, the defense budget, rock and roll. PLATO had a primitive version of email called personal notes, public group notes that served as bulletin boards, and one-on-one chat called term type. The PLATO community piloted all the tropes that would become common in online communities, including men impersonating women. And like the community memory terminals emerging simultaneously in the Bay Area, it had its own wonky, grassroots counterculture. Marisa was, in PLATO slang, a Z-brat, a kid using her father's login to mingle on the nascent network. She doesn't remember ever seeing another female Z-brat, but she made her share of online friends. Beyond the flirtation with the boss's son, she chatted with college students in Boulder, Colorado, and in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois, where the PLATO software was being developed. PLATO users shared recipes, gave each other love advice, used emoticons, and played fantasy role-playing games. For a suburban kid in the Midwest, all of this was totally unexpected, as though a household appliance had suddenly become a window into another dimension. PLATO altered the course of Marisa's life. When most people her age still thought of computers as monolithic calculators in university basements, she understood that once connected, they became social machines. It would take a decade for the rest of the world to catch up, and by the time it did, Marisa had a head start. As Marisa grew older, she couldn't quite shake her fascination with words on screens. Trying LSD for the first time, she laid on her back in the yard, watching her mother-of-pearl cigarette smoke coil beneath the stars, which seemed to her like a TV set, moving around and forming words which I couldn't read. When she moved to New York in 1985, during the Donald and Ivana Trump merger and acquisition junk bond boom time, she discovered BBS culture and the well. "Oh my God," she thought. "This is just like PLATO, but with interesting people." She was eager to relive her adolescent flirtations, but the well didn't do it for her. On today's web, geographical distance doesn't count for much beyond tonal differences. Emails from abroad arrive at seemingly strange hours, and East Coast late-night Twitter dead-ends into the West Coast morning feed. But in the dial-up days, a significant technological and cultural boundary divided the East and West Coast internet. These digital Rockies presented Marisa with two insurmountable passes. Dialing into the well was a long-distance phone call, with the accompanying costs. And once she dialed in, there would be deadheads. I'm allergic to the Grateful Dead, she confessed in a 2011 interview. Thankfully, another tech-savvy New Yorker named Stacey Horn had just had an identical crisis. After Marisa Beau gave up on the well, she discovered Echo, a local call, where Jerry Garcia's name was verboten. The way she tells the story, it was love at first keystroke. I logged on to Echo, and 4 years later, I looked up. The diverse community and the alternative it presented from traditional media was seductive and novel. She loved the idea that you could converse and get opinions from people who weren't like the 12 guys from Harvard who ran the New Yorker, Harper's, and the Atlantic. Marisa lived in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, so she gave herself the username Miss Outer Borough. As Mob, she posted constantly, to the point where her real-life friends started to worry. They felt sorry for me, she tells me now, with a gleeful cackle, Skyping from her Williamsburg apartment on a hot summer day, almost exactly 20 years later. They felt it was such a losery thing to do. Little did they know that Miss Outer Borough had a cult following. Marisa's natural instinct for online conversation had made her an instant Echo favorite. Where she was shy in real life, she was bold and irrepressible online. She makes me spit out my coffee on my keyboard more than any other person on Echo, Stacey Horn wrote. Stacey appreciated Marisa's presence on Echo so much that she begged her to host the culture conference. Marisa knew how to draw worthwhile conversation out of people. Although getting a good thread going online could be like pulling teeth, she had the constitution for it. A combination of patience and magnetism, with a quick wit and a fast girl charisma that popped from the screen. She knows she's smart, powerful, and beautiful, wrote Stacey. Part tart, those formative years cyber-flirting on Plato had served her well. Part total queen. She became the conference manager, the host of hosts, and the object of plenty of one-sided ardor. Half of Echo was dying of love for her for the longest time. On Echo, Marisa was the ultimate arbiter of cool. The writer, Clay Shirky, called her the Henry James of the alley. In a sense, she was one of the earliest online influencers, so popular that she sometimes felt uncomfortable turning up for Echo's in-person events. It was like a mini celebrity experience, she recalls. But although she was a big deal on the internet, her real life wasn't always so glamorous. She spent a lot of time holed up in her apartment, nose to a screen of endless text, its white words on blue, scrolling like clouds through the sky. To pay rent, she took temp word processing jobs. It hadn't yet occurred to her that she might be able to combine the two. The biggest bitch in Silicon Alley. In 1994, a new personality tore across Echo. Her real name was Jamie Levy, but in a nihilistic nod to Kurt Cobain's suicide, she posted online as Kurt's Brains. An inveterate Nirvana fan, she looked the part. Her peroxide blonde hair was usually gelled into upright whorls, and she was rarely photographed without a skateboard, a hand-rolled cigarette, and an oversized flannel shirt. Jamie grew up a latchkey kid in the San Fernando Valley, freely roaming the haze-tinted sprawl. While her brother stayed indoors to mess around with the family Commodore 64, she preferred the punk rock scene, then at its cultural apex in late 1970s Los Angeles. Computers didn't appeal to her. The command line language her brother was always banging onto his keyboard didn't look creative at all. In her first year of film school in San Francisco, a boyfriend showed her how to make animations on an Amiga, the successor to her brother's Commodore 64. It clicked. Computers are punk. She started adding computer graphics to her experimental films. By 21, she was already too big for her britches in San Francisco. The video art scene was overrun with people who didn't care about money, she tells me now, at 50. I knew that I needed to be viable. I didn't want to be a starving artist. She turned in her thesis film, an effects-laden skate video, and bought a plane ticket to New York City, having decided that NYU's Interactive Telecommunications Program, ITP, was for her. Some of her favorite filmmakers, Jim Jarmusch, Spike Lee, had graduated from NYU, and it seemed like an interesting time to be in New York. There was video art being screened at the kitchen, and this interesting band, Sonic Youth, was playing gigs in the city. In typical style, she marched into the Tisch building at NYU without an appointment. The move was part bombast, part desperation. She didn't think she could have gotten an interview if she tried. She wandered around the fourth floor until someone led her to the office of Red Burns, the program's venerable chair, a bristly, red-headed matriarch some called the godmother of Silicon Alley. Jamie was intimidated, but she had only 2 days in the city, so she told Burns she wanted to tell stories using computers. Later, she joked that everyone at ITP was there on a Citibank scholarship to design ATM machines. Burns took a shine to Jamie, the kid with a skateboard and an Amiga, who she may have seen as a swift kick to the program. I think she saw the opportunity to attract younger people who wanted to push technology in new ways for art, for entertainment, for publishing, for everything. Burns gave Jamie a full ride. Jamie spent her years at NYU experimenting with interactive media. For her master's thesis, she combined the do-it-yourself ethos of punk with the emerging possibilities of desktop publishing, producing an electronic magazine, Cyber Rag, on floppy disk. With color-printed labels crazy glued onto each disk, Cyber Rag looked the part of a punk rock fanzine. Loaded onto a consumer Mac, Jamie's stories came to life with images pilfered from The Village Voice, The Whole Earth Review, Mondo 2000, and Newsweek, collaged together on screen as though they'd been Xeroxed by hand. Cyber Rag was programmed in Apple HyperCard, with graphics drawn in Mac Paint. Along with her animations, she added edgy interactive games. In one, you chase Manuel Noriega around Panama. Hacker how-tos, and catty musings about hippies sneaking into computer trade shows and cyberspace. Before the first graphical web browsers brought hypertext to the masses, Jamie was publishing discs she thought would replace print magazines. They were rewritable, after all. If you hate it, take the files off, throw them away, put your own files on it, she told a reporter in 1993. After grad school, Jamie moved back to Los Angeles and renamed her magazine Electronic Hollywood. When the city was upended by the 1992 LA uprising, she couldn't leave her Koreatown apartment for 4 days. She climbed up to her building's roof with a camcorder and filmed the streets. There were fires everywhere. We called it Smell-O-Vision, she said, because you could run back downstairs and turn on the TV and there would be smoke coming inside the building. She added those images to Electronic Hollywood, alongside an editorial about the experience. I feel like a survivor of a post-Reagan morning after, it reads, as a clanging industrial sample plays on loop. I can't even walk to buy beer anymore. Los Angeles. Love it or loot it. In filmed interviews from this time, Jamie's SoCal affect, to this day, she speaks in a deep valley brogue, belies a very real intensity. In one profile produced by the Los Angeles public television affiliate, KCET, she spins her office chair around in a room plastered with concert flyers, describing the electronic magazines offhandedly as my sort of digital graffiti. But despite her show of Gen X disinterest, Jamie was at the absolute vanguard of electronic publishing. Nobody had ever produced anything like Cyber Rag or Electronic Hollywood. There had been some interactive HyperCard stacks, downloadable from BBSs, and a few interactive art discs for Commodore Amiga. But Jamie's discs, packaged on floppy, were accessible to anyone with a Mac, and with their hypertext links and interactive animations, they were exactly like websites, long before the web existed. Although she had a day job as a typesetter, she distributed Electronic Hollywood to indie book and record stores, where they routinely sold out. The novelty got her national media attention, which she leveraged into mail-order sales. After her magazines were featured in an issue of Mondo 2000, the cyber culture's magazine of record, she was flooded with orders and fan mail. Although she made only 5 issues, she sold more than 6,000 copies at $6 a pop. Not bad for discs that cost less than 50 cents to produce. When Jamie finally moved back to New York, she became Silicon Alley's first real celebrity, a poster girl for a new generation of 20-something media titans ready to reboot the world. She was the first, truly iconoclastic, magazine profile-ready, female face of the emerging digital culture. It helped that she photographed well. Surly-faced in polyvinyl pants and boots for a 1996 Esquire story about girls who just want to be wired, or in her omnipresent grungy flannel and tube socks, clutching a skateboard in a Newsweek who's who. The net was big news, and she made a compelling figurehead. Young, edgy, with attitude for miles. "I was the Kurt Cobain of the internet," she told the Village Voice at the tail end of the decade. Only half kidding. Jamie really knew how to present herself, remembers Marisa Bow. She would go to Mac conventions and diss them in that little zine voice. Zine kids were always saying, "We hate these bands and we hate those bands." She was doing the same thing, but about computers and on a floppy disk with her own music, and I thought it was just brilliant. She was a hacker through and through. In her loft, a television screen doubled as her Mac monitor, and a flashing red light, the kind usually reserved for the hearing impaired, signaled incoming calls over the din of her stereo. Instead of treating the computer like a precious object, Jamie dragged it by the power cord, banging every curb along the mean streets of L.A. and New York. The first issue of Electronic Hollywood opened with a tongue-in-cheek greeting that pretty much sums up her style at the time. "If you have never seen an electronic magazine before," it read, "then I hope this trips you out." Anyone who was anyone in the emerging tech counterculture had copies of Cyber Rag and Electronic Hollywood. Even Billy Idol, the British rock star, was a fan. He came across Electronic Hollywood at the height of his own cyberpunk phase, as he was working on a record about sex, drugs, and computers called, appropriately, Cyberpunk. Idol loved Jamie's floppies and decided he needed one for his album. They worked out a deal. For $5,000, Jamie would make Billy Idol an interactive floppy disk of his own. It would be just like hers, with his lyrics in place of her rants and band reviews, and would come packaged in a folding cardboard sleeve alongside his CD. Her first corporate gig, and the world's first interactive press kit. "He just really wanted to party with me," Jamie remembers. One night, at Manhattan's infamous Club Fuck, they got so wasted that Billy threw her across the table and broke her arm. "I was supposed to be animating his disc. I had to, like, do the whole thing with my non-mouse hand." Idol's album flopped, but Jamie kept her rep as a savvy netizen. She got a straight job, commuting to White Plains to do bonehead interface design at IBM. In her baggy plaid shirts, she was often mistaken for a janitor, and was tapped by Viacom to make an interactive press kit for Aerosmith on CD-ROM. But she was too young and too punk to go totally corporate, and she was getting bored with physical media. "Who's gonna buy this shit? Who cares about these CD-ROMs?" she wondered. A coworker at IBM showed her Mosaic, the first browser for navigating the World Wide Web. She experienced it as a conversion. Her electronic magazines were websites, before websites existed, built exactly the same way, with hypertext navigation and pages of sound, video, and text. "Once the browser came out, I was like, I'm not making fixed format anymore. I'm learning HTML, and that was it." She quit her day job. Around that time, Jamie started hosting parties in her Avenue A loft. She called them cyber slacker parties, updating the Gen X honorific for the wired generation. Cyber Slacker was the first of the Silicon Alley parties. Within a few years, the flush of dot-com money in New York would turn the Flatiron District into a bacchanal of rare proportions. Multi-million dollar startups with names like Razorfish and DoubleClick burned their IPO money on go-go dancers and vodka pyramids as their CEOs became celebrities, their risque party pictures leaping from the Silicon Alley Reporter to Page Six. The most infamous of the Alley parties were funded by an early web streaming company, Sudo, whose CEO, Josh Harris, was notorious for bringing together tech socialites, hungry entrepreneurs, artists, musicians, and New York club kids in increasingly extravagant environments. On the eve of the millennium, Harris burned more than $1 million on a month-long experiment in communal living. Over two adjoining warehouses, citizens, in matching uniforms, lived, ate, drank, had sex, and shot guns under the gaze of hundreds of streaming digital cameras until they were shut down by the NYPD on New Year's Day, 2000. The cops thought they were a Y2K cult. Maybe they were. "Josh Harris always says he didn't copy me," says Jamie, who would never have his resources. But it's impossible that he didn't. Her parties may not have been as outrageous, but they had a bigger effect. Part rave, part hackathon, CyberSlacker sparked the tinder of a uniquely New York tech scene, which was defined by a preponderance, as one historian puts it, of principled slackers, arty punk rockers, and deconstructionists from good families. Many of these saw the web for the first time in Jamie's loft, on a Mac 2 her hacker friend Fiber Optic, Echo's sometime tech support, set up with a 28.8K internet connection. As avant-garde guitarist Elliot Sharp performed live, and another friend, DJ Spooky, played house tracks, Jamie's guests gathered around the Mac's small screen. At the top of 1994, there were fewer than 1,000 websites in the world, mostly personal homepages. "That's all that was up there," Jamie remembers. "Like, hi, my name is Lisa, and here's my dog." From these humble beginnings, however, the right witnesses extrapolated the essential. Like Jamie, they saw how irrelevant the web made everything they'd done before. These converts would call themselves the early true believers, counting the year of their arrival online as a mark of status, the way the first punks claimed 1977. Soon after the bubble popped, a New York Magazine story about Jamie and her peers nailed the timeline. 1995 is cool. 1996 or early 1997 is all right. Anything after that is not. 2000 makes you a real loser. A suit. A kid just out of college. A 50-ish businessman looking for one last hurrah and another $100 million. The web gave the early true believers creative, spiritual purpose and offered them an opportunity to sidestep the media giants that seemed to hold the only key to creative employment in recession-era New York. "It turned us all into apostles," one Ali Seamster proclaimed. It wasn't a money thing. It was, hey, here's this pure channel. Then, of course, the money came to town. And for a short while, they became the giants. Word. Jamie was always telling Marisa Beau she should get into electronic publishing. "I didn't know what she meant," Marisa says. "I mean, I liked electronics, and I liked publishing, so I probably would like it." She wasn't alone. Beyond Jamie's floppies and a few early experiments on the web, publishing online was an unknown quantity. For Marisa, that would change in 1995, when a software company called Icon CMT tapped Jamie, then at the height of her fame, to be the creative director of a new online magazine called Word. The budget was good, or at least more than nothing, which is what Jamie had in the cyber rag days. The editor-in-chief, Jonathan Van Meter, was an industry veteran who'd previously helmed Vibe. It seemed like he'd let Jamie be Jamie, the snarky, pot-smoking doyen of the cyber underground. The team was hers to assemble. The last thing she wanted was for Word to feel trendy, like Billy Idol's failed foray into cyberpunk. She trusted only one person to ensure Word would be cool, her friend, Marisa Beau, a.k.a. Miss Outer Borough, whose spellbinding effect she'd witnessed firsthand on Echo. When Marisa went to interview for the job, she decided not to pretend like I'm some super straight magazine person, she tells me. And by straight, I mean gets along well in the corporate world. But she and Van Meter hit it off, and he hired her as Word's managing editor. Having never worked in the magazine world, she had no idea what that meant. In fact, putting a magazine on the web at all was a new proposition. Word would be among the first. To say there was no business model is an understatement. Word's backers assumed that online publishing would be a subscription business. Like traditional magazines, readers would subscribe, and because there'd be no printing or distribution costs, the profit margin would be huge. They'd be selling something ineffable, again and again, without ever running low on inventory. The dot-com era's delusion of choice. Icon thought they'd make millions in a matter of months. Van Meter dropped out shortly before Word's 1995 launch. Jamie says it's because he didn't know anything about the web. Marisa suggests that Icon hadn't been straight with him about the editorial budget, which he was accustomed to having in Condé Nast proportions. His absence left Marisa at the helm, technically unqualified, but totally right for the job. With her head start on online culture, she knew how to approach a medium by looking at what it was. Marisa would later say that while she appreciated what would become Word's primary competition, brainy online magazines like Salon, Slate, and Feed, she loved the homespun feeling of bulletin board systems and personal homepages much more. Amateur writing, Marisa observed, is the bread and butter of the internet. In a 1996 roundtable discussion with a handful of other online editors, she confessed to being hooked on amateur stuff. At best, it's fascinating, passionate, intimate, unpredictable, and disarmingly lacking in artifice. She brought that sensibility to Word, which published almost exclusively accounts of everyday people's experiences. The site's most popular section featured weekly testimonials from people in every line of work imaginable, edited down from interviews largely conducted by Marisa's brother, John, a Studs Terkel for the Digital Village. He went on cross-country road trips to find real people to interview, and Word published his transcribed accounts of the lives of prostitutes, hat salesmen, UPS delivery men, and heavy metal roadies. Word staff weren't above sharing their own stories either. The masthead was a showcase of entries from everyone in the office, and Marisa went so far as to publish snippets of her own high school journals, mastering the confessional tone of proto-blogs. Her very first editorial was an abridged life story. Speedboating on Lake Minnetonka, her father's ice cubes rattling in the boat's cup holder, being first on the school bus and singing along to King of the Road with the acne-riddled driver, hating her fascist-looking brownie uniform. It includes a recipe for beans and a passage in Pig Latin. Word was documentary, not commentary. Marisa felt that what mattered about the internet, and what was at risk of being lost, was the voice of individual people. What was fundamentally most fascinating and different about the internet, Marisa tells me, was that people are the medium that you're working with. As Marisa honed authentic stories, chasing the human touch that had first hooked her as a teenage Z-brat, Jamie Levy focused on more literal interactivity. She described her goals to a reporter soon after the site launched. In the world of Word, we don't just read see Spot run. We have a three-dimensional encounter in which Spot not only barks and bites, but in which you might want to carry a pooper scooper. Like that analogy, the interactive features Jamie designed for Word were both startlingly original and characteristically caustic, like Word's chatbot, Fred the Webmate, a pixelated, misanthropic New Yorker you could talk to by typing questions. Fred was damaged, with sexual issues he often alluded to but never addressed. If pressed, he claimed to have been recently laid off by a large new media company. Even the name Webmate was sort of playing a joke, Marisa explains, on those crappy, helpful avatars companies were starting to put on their websites, all shades of Clippy, the dreaded Microsoft Word paperclip. Here are a few more things you might have found on Word.com circa 1996. Photo essays of Russian prison tattoos and Manhattan clocks. Body paper dolls. Found thrift store paintings. An interactive game in which the objective is to pop zits. Dean Martin horoscopes and clip art comics. Meaningless interactive toys, like a cartoon microwave you drag a dog into. Depressing children's stories. Photographs of empty billboards and road signs taken across the country. Scanned cocktail napkins with phone numbers and the sad, sexy stories of the people who scrawled them. At least one first-person account from someone who got a coffee enema. Word was not the first magazine on the web, but it was the first to demonstrate the creative possibilities of online publishing, and its formula worked. By 1998, Word was logging 95,000 daily page views and 1 to 2 million hits a week, which was massive traffic in those days. Newsweek announced Word as its readers' favorite online destination. And the New York Times used the site as an example in one of its earliest articles about web browsers. Even the first commercial web browser, Netscape, which was used by essentially every person online in the mid-1990s, gave it a place of privilege. Netscape had a row of buttons beneath the URL field. What's new? What's cool? Destinations, net search, people, and software. People led to an early internet white pages. Software to Netscape's own upgrades. What's cool? Pointed to Word.com. Everyone at Word shared a certain basic aesthetic. Twin Peaks, zines, pop culture, weird homepages. Marisa once compared herself and Jamie to the Beavis and Butthead of the internet, but the magazine functioned more like a rock band than a publishing entity, and Marisa and Jamie made great front women. Jamie and I had as much a chance as anyone, just the two of us, at doing something good, says Marisa. Where Jamie was obsessed with multimedia, she would literally hiss about text, Marisa says, and laughs. Marisa knew how to cultivate writers. One particularly dynamite photo of the two of them from this era might as well be a band photo. On the rooftop of the Word office, Jamie in combat boots and track pants, Marisa in a leather jacket, a smoking computer at their feet, screen smashed to bits. But as in any good rock band, egos ran wild. In the escalating fever of the dot-com boom, it was hard for Jamie to stay centered. Silicon Alley was changing fast. Friends who had been techno-bohemian party people only a few years previous were becoming millionaires. Right before joining Word, Jamie had turned down a one-third stake in a web development shop, Razorfish, that was now on the eve of a $1.8 billion IPO. We knew people who were getting filthy rich, Marisa says. With opportunities passing left and right, Jamie started to get itchy. And there were other tensions. The public persona Jamie had been cultivating in the press for so long, as a rule-breaking digital zinester, was starting to get on her coworkers' nerves. All the attention was on me, she admits, instead of on what it should have been. She was a strong brew, always blasting her music loud and gunning to work on her own stuff. She wandered away from Word after a year and a half to pursue freelance contracts on her own. Although a Silicon Alley gossip column at the time pegged Jamie's departure as a power move, Jamie Levy has the last word. Jamie wishes now that she could have hung on a little longer. I've never been a person to last anywhere with anybody, she says. Marisa stayed on. It hurt to lose her partner in crime, but the idea of leaving Word was unimaginable. It was the fulfillment of every creative dream and urge and idea that I'd ever had, she says. To pass that up, I just felt would be like cutting my heart out. The death of the web as we know it. At the tail end of 1996, Jamie Levy threw her last cyber slacker party. She went all out for this one, upgrading from her loft to the Clock Tower Gallery in Tribeca and asking some of her more illustrious alley friends to come on stage and do rants. As New York avant-garde stalwarts like Laurie Anderson and Lou Reed mingled in the crowd, Nicholas Butterworth, a former punk bassist whose music website had been bought by Viacom, wailed for 15 minutes into the mic. "It's the death of the web as we knew it," he screamed. "It's over. And wasn't it good while it lasted? Who was there? Who was there in 1995? Reaping it in. The money, the fame, the parties, all of it flowing in. It was beautiful. Everyone here, all my friends, doing creative things with a capital C. The dream was to be a media assassin, to be a gorilla, and to be paid. Well, let me tell you something. You now have a choice. You can be a gorilla, or you can get paid. You cannot do both." Jamie chose to get paid, but she ended up being a gorilla. She left her mark on Word. The magazine kept her flash, her pooper scooper, interactivity, and her choice hires. Beyond Marisa, there was Yoshi Sodoeka, who filled Jamie's shoes as art director. Yoshi was one of these Japanese kids that had come to the United States because he wanted to do punk rock, originally. Like basically everyone else at Word, he'd never worked in publishing, but he had designed interfaces for kiosks back in Japan. The result was a pop graphic sensibility that earned the magazine its share of copycats, and Yoshi his share of lucrative job offers, all of which he declined. "He's an artist," Marisa says admiringly. Yoshi was the first to make icons a core element of site design. Even today, his art direction holds up. Word had an office in Midtown, in the Gray Bar building above Grand Central Station. Compared to other Silicon Alley workplaces, it was relatively anonymous. "We were essentially artists and bohemians, not trying to be hip," Marisa remembers. She instinctively mistrusted the playground offices of their peers. All the ping-pong tables, beanbags, and fancy conference rooms felt suffocating. Of course, Word was a product of the boom, too. Marisa doesn't remember if the site even made money, because although its sales department sold ads at around $12,500 a pop in the early days, it largely functioned as a sexy PR toy for its parent company. For us, the creative team, it was like we were pulling a long scam, one longtime Word employee, Naomi Clark, explains. Despite Word's heartfelt authenticity and its experimental design, the site existed as a sort of trophy wife for these much less glamorous internet businesses that were in the process of selling infrastructure and T1 lines. At the height of the bubble, all that really mattered was to generate some healthy interest before an IPO. "Going public was the business model, period," Marisa concedes. "An icon CMT wanted to get the killing and get out, just like everyone else." Like many online publishing concerns with no clear revenue model, Word was precarious from the outset. By the late 1990s, technology investors finally hipped to the fact that although content is king, this being the unofficial mantra of alley types in the early years, so much so that Word staff printed ironic t-shirts reading "content provider" in big block type, the increasing volume of free content on the web would drive advertising rates into the ground, and nobody was going to pay for subscriptions to digital magazines. Word was brusquely shut down by its parent company in March 1998, prompting a flurry of obituaries. A competing online magazine, Suck.com, pondered its D.B. Cooperish disappearance. Wired called it the end of an era. But by September, it was back from the dead. Here's where the story gets weird. Being a trophy wife on the arm of an infrastructure company was one thing, but the holding company that bought Word for $2 billion in 1998 made industrial-grade fish meal. "It made so little sense," Naomi says and laughs. They had a slightly misbegotten idea that they could start up a media business, and having some sort of known brand names in the mix would be useful for that. Such odd bedfellows are less startling in the woozy context of the bubble. Their new owner, Zapata Corporation, was founded as an oil company in Houston in 1953 by a young George Bush, before being retooled into a food processing business by a second owner. In the tech bubble, it was reinventing itself once again as Zap.com, a web portal for the content coast. Zapata's CEO, Avram Glazer, took out full-page ads in the New York Times, "Zap will buy your website," and entered into negotiations to purchase 30. Word was their marquee acquisition, signaling to alley investors that Zap was a serious internet company. Marisa hired back her staff, all the underachieving sub-geniuses who smoked too much pot and took too much acid in high school. The band was back together. Even Fred the Webmate returned for a second season. In the new installment, he was back at work too, pacing the halls of a corporate office, working data entry. Visitors could still chat with him, only now the conversations took place while Fred hid in the bathroom, drank Cokes, and did push-ups in the office kitchen. He claimed to be happy and said he'd have a better job soon, but his mood swings were still violent. Maybe Fred would never really get what he wanted. But on the eve of Y2K, on its last glorious lap around Silicon Alley, Word did. Electronic Hollywood. In 1998, Jamie Levy was invited back to NYU to to give a lecture to students about Electronic Hollywood, the company she'd started a few years after leaving Word. She tells me what she told the university. I was like, okay, why don't we call it How to Spend $500,000 in 1 Year and All I